Rick, go.
Somebody once said, when nothing is sure, everything is possible. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Christian Questions, talk radio with a purpose with Jonathan and Rick. The objective of our program is to discuss with you, our listeners, thought-provoking and meaningful topics based on the Bible. This is a call-in format. We are caller-friendly, and we certainly look forward to hearing your point of view. For those of you who may be listening for the first time, our perspective is this. We believe that there is one God, and through him there is one truth which is found in the Bible. Our purpose is to stir your thinking up along with ours as we continually search for clarity and understanding this one truth.
While we are not here to teach, we are here to seriously provoke your thinking according to Hebrews 10:24, which is the theme for our program. And let us consider one another to provoke unto love and good works. This provoking is encouraged by Isaiah 1:18. Come now and let us reason together. We look to frame our comments in the context of 1 Thessalonians 5, verses 19 and 21. Quench not the Spirit, prove all things, hold fast that which is good. And the only end result we seek to accomplish is to bring praise, honor, and glory to God our Father and Jesus our Lord.
And if you'd like to contact us or suggest a topic for a future program, receive a Christian Questions travel mug. This is what you do.
You write us at Christian Questions, P.O. Box 1837, New London, Connecticut, 06320, or check us out on the web at www.christianquestions.net. Today is October 23rd, 2005. All audio and printed material are copyrighted and are the property of Christian Questions.
And, folks, if you do have a question, you want to reopen a previously aired topic, we can certainly entertain that thought, so let us know. On behalf of Jonathan, my co-host.
Good morning, Rick.
And Fred, the guy behind the board there.
Good morning, Rick.
Hey, Fred, how are you? We want to welcome you to this hour of our program.
Hey, Rick, you sound far away. Where are you?
Well, you know, sometimes you tell me I'm far away even when I'm sitting right in front of you. But I am in Edison, New Jersey this morning, and with our dear friend Ken Rawson, and we are doing the program from here. And Jonathan, hold on to your hat, because it's going to be an interesting 2 hours this morning.
Sounds great.
So what's the question?
All right, Rick, our question is, what are God's... actually, we forgot about last week. Remember we talked about what are God's rules for his church?
Ah, yes. That was an interesting conversation. We looked at a scriptural perspective on the organization and the rules, if you will, that God puts in place for the his true church. And found some interesting things that may not be as mainline as a lot of people might have thought, but it's in the scriptures, so it was a very interesting discussion. But okay. This week, the question is,
do the Palestinians or Israel belong in Gaza? And our theme text is found in Exodus 32, verse 13. Remember Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, thy servants, to whom thou swearest by thine own self, and sayest unto them, I will multiply your seed as the stars of heaven, and all this land that I have spoken of will I give unto your seed, and they shall inherit it forever.
All right, and Jonathan, when it comes to the Middle East and to current events, there are two words that conjure up all kinds of emotions. Those words are Israel and land. Surrounded by some 226 million Arab neighbors, this small nation of less than 7 million, with maybe 5 million plus Jews and 1 million Arabs, always seems to be a center of attention. Why? Do the Jews belong in Israel, or do the Palestinians? Where did the Jews in the region come from? Where did the Palestinians in that region come from? What about Gaza and the West Bank? Who has rights to these regions? This morning we will open up this very difficult and charged topic with a fascinating look at these issues and more, as usual, from a Bible perspective. So, Jonathan, with us here, as I mentioned, we have Ken Rawson. Good morning, Ken.
Good morning, Rick, and good morning, all you listeners out there.
Ken, you've been with us a number of times before.
Yes, very enjoyable times.
That's good you said that. And we've spent actually a lot of time while you're with us talking about Israel and the subject of Israel and prophecy and the future of Israel. And Ken, before we get started on the subject proper, just give us a little bit of your background and some of your experience in dealing with the subject of Israel specifically.
All right. I've been a minister of the Bible Students Congregation of New Brunswick for over 40 years. Of course, as a Christian minister, you're interested in the Bible, and one-third of the Bible, over one-third of the Bible, is prophecy. And a major part of those prophecies pertain to the Jewish people and the nation of Israel and their past, present, and future. So that has always been an intriguing subject, especially since 1947, when Israel, after centuries and centuries of centuries being non-existent as a nation, became a nation. I would say from about 1979, from my first trip to Israel, it became a pet subject. And I have lectured throughout North America and Europe on the subject of Israel. I visit Israel very frequently. There was a period of time, many years, that I went there three times a year. And, of course, every time I go, I have meetings with various government leaders, from Prime Minister on down at times, and members of the Knesset, which is their legislative body, and also with the religious leaders and the rabbis, major rabbis in Israel. So, and I produced several videos on Israel that have been translated into Russian, Ukrainian, Romanian, Hungarian language, and especially the Hebrew language, and is being used extensively in Israel. So you could say this is one of my major areas of research and study.
And it's certainly not just merely a pet topic, but is a pet passion.
Yeah.
And that's an important thing. And, folks, the reason we're asking Ken to be with us this morning on this particular subject is because of his extensive experience, not only with the subject, but with the people and his unique positioning as a Christian who has this incredible interest in Israel from a biblical and prophetic standpoint, and also his unique position as an individual who has sat down and talked with many very high-ranking government officials in Israel and gotten a different perspective than you may have heard anywhere else on this. So, folks, this morning we are going to spend our time talking about Israel. We're going to be talking about the land situation. They recently, just a couple of months ago, walked out of Gaza and have been evacuating parts of the West Bank. And the big question is, why are they doing this? Should they be doing this? Who has rights to what? And so forth. So as we get started, Jonathan, we have a few basic questions. We got a lot of questions, so we're not going to rattle them off this morning. But let's get right into this. And, folks, if you have a thought on this matter, give us a call at 442-6102. That's 860-442-6102. So, Ken, as we get started with this, the big question to start with, there's two questions I want to just for groundwork. Who are the Israelis and who are the Palestinians? Who are these people?
Okay, we'll start with the Israelis. I'm sure you're referring to Jews when you say Israelis.
Yes, I am.
Because they live in the land of Israel, and they lived in the land of Israel centuries ago. And actually, ever since that time, there's always been Jews in that land. Now, I think most Christians and even non-active Christians who live in Christian nations, let's say Western Hemisphere and Europe, they just believe and understand that the Jews are the descendants of Abraham,
mm-hmm.
and they were given the land. Now, this has only been challenged since the so-called Palestinians, who are really Arabs, came up with some really highly I'll just say nonsensical theories that actually the Jews never, never in the land in the past, and that the Palestinian were always in the land. They were the Canaanites. They were the Philistines.
Mm-hmm.
And no scientific study of the families of nations that will adhere or confirm or even give any remote credence to that theory. So it's really actually only the Arabs and those who have accepted the Arab propaganda that challenge that there have been Jews in the land for this period of time. Okay, so most of our audience will be Christians or those acquainted with the Bible. And you're well acquainted with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Abraham was called from the Chaldean country to go to Israel, the land that God would give them, that later became Israel. And if he did this, God made a promise to him. In thee and thy seed shall all the nations of the earth be blessed. Abraham went to the promised land. He had a son, Isaac, and the promise was reiterated to Isaac. But when it was reiterated to Isaac, special mention was made of a land that would be given to the descendants of Abraham and Isaac. And that land was what is now Israel, the territory of Israel. Then Isaac died, and he had his elder son Jacob received the same promise, and thee and thy seed shall all the families of the earth be blessed, and they're going to receive this particular land. And then Jacob's name was changed to Israel. So that's where the term Israel comes up. Jacob had 12 sons. They married. They had families. And the 12 sons of Jacob, or Israel, and their families became the nucleus of the Jewish nation, who God, centuries later, instructed to go and take the land of Canaan for moral reasons. And that would be their land, that promised land, give a promise to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. That would be their land eternally. Now, we say Jews, and these are the Jews. Now, let's define Jews a little better. Actually, the term Jews came from Judah, the name Judah. The nation of Israel was divided into 12 tribes. 12 sons of
Judah was one of them.
And Judah was one of them. And actually, Judah and Benjamin became Judah. So technically, the Jews are from the two-tribe segment of the nation of Israel, Benjamin and Judah. And all of the rest would be Israelis, but technically not Jews. But you know how definitions change over time.
Right.
So it's accepted now that all Israelis from the lineage of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob are Jews. That's the terminology.
Okay. So that gives us a sense then that you're and we're going to come back to this thought because it's important. You've established Israel, if you will, from a biblical perspective. And we're gonna hang that thought over to the side for a few minutes and come back to that shortly. Before we get into a little bit more on the Palestinians, though, you've established who the Israelis are or the Jews are. Jonathan, maybe we should do the break at this point, and when we come back in from the break, we'll get into a little bit more of the Palestinians, and then we'll talk about the history of Gaza, and then come back to this biblical perspective on who belongs where.
This is Jonathan and Rick with Christian Questions on News Talk 102.3 FM, WXLM. Do the Palestinians or Israel belong in Gaza? Grab your Bibles. Don't go away. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Christian Questions on News Talk 102.3 FM, WXLM. Our subject this segment, do Palestinians or Jews belong in Gaza? To be a part of our program, call 860-442-6102. That's 442-6102. And we're here on air with our special guest, Ken Rawson.
And Jonathan, I am here in New Jersey with Ken in Edison, New Jersey. We're sitting at his dining room table. It's very comfortable here. And we're in the midst of our discussion. We just got started in the first segment. We were really defining who the Israelis are. And we did that primarily from a biblical perspective because that's where their heritage comes from. And just before the break, we mentioned we wanted to discuss a little bit of who the Palestinians are. So, Ken, who are the Palestinians? Where do they come from? What's their heritage? Give us the rundown.
All right. We'll use two perspectives. The first is a scripture perspective. I think we have a very interesting prophecy in Ezekiel 36. And I call it the love story between God and the land, not God and the Jewish people, because this is actually a prophecy concerning the land of Israel. I'll begin with verse 3, and it might be a little lengthy, but I want to go all the way down to verse 11 because I think it's very revealing. Therefore prophesy and say, thus saith the Lord God, because they, your enemies, have made you desolate and swallowed you up on every side, that ye might be a possession unto the residue of the heathen, and ye are taken up in the lips of talkers and are an infamy of the people. Therefore, ye mountains of Israel, hear the word of the Lord. Thus saith God, the Lord God, to the mountains, to the hills, and to the rivers, and to the valleys, and to the desolate wastes. These are the territories in Israel. To the desolate waste and to the cities that are forsaken, which became a prey and derision to the residue of the heathen round about. Then he followed this refrain. I won't take the time for verses 5 through 7. And he uses this phrase again, that Israel was made desolate by the heathen round about. All right, there was a time that because of Israel's continual sinning against the law covenant God made with them, that he permitted them to be dispersed and the land left without Jews to a large extent. And it, according to this prophecy, was made desolate by the people round about. Well, who were the people round about Israel? The Arab nations.
And there's a lot of them.
There, right now there's 22 of them. But it was the Arab nations that made the people desolate. And the Lord was angry with this. And I'll just sum that up in verse 7. Therefore, thus saith the Lord God, I have lifted up mine hand. Surely the heathen that are round about you, they shall bear their shame. Why? Because they desolated Israel. And in that connection it says, but ye, O mountains of Israel, ye shall shoot forth your branches and yield your fruit to my people of Israel, for they shall come, return. For behold, I am for you, and I will turn unto you, and ye shall till and sow and multiply men on the land, and it shows how that Israel will return to the fertility of the of old times. So it is the people round about, the Arabs that moved into the land after the Jews were dispersed by God, and they just desolated the land. For instance, there would be a building, and they would put up their tent next to the building. They wouldn't live in the building. They'd live in the tent. They'd keep warm by a fire. They'd tear down the building to burn, use as wood. And their goats just made the land destitute. And it became a barren wilderness. And the Royal Palestinian Commission, commissioned by the nation of England in 1937 to review the history of the land and the problem between the Jews and the Arabs in the land, they lay the blame at the feet of the Arabs that came in from nations round about. They were the ones that made the land so desolate. Okay, that's biblical history. Now, who are the Palestinians? Well, I think the clearest definition of who the Palestinians are was given us in Time magazine. And read this quote, and it says that, quote, Golda Meir once argued that there was no such thing as a Palestinian. At that time, she wasn't entirely wrong. Before Arafat began his proselytizing, most of the Arabs from the territory of Palestine thought of themselves as members of an all-embracing Arab nation. It was Arafat who made the intellectual leap to a definition of the Palestinians as a distinct people. He articulated the cause, organized for it, fought for it, and brought it to the world's attention. Unquote. And this quote is actually from Time magazine. Let's look up the source here so you can have it. Time magazine, January 3rd, 1994. And Arafat didn't come on the scene to try to crystallize the Arabs in Palestine, or so-called Palestine, until the 1960s. So it wasn't until the 1960s that the Arabs who lived in Palestine for whatever period of time, we'll say from the time that Israel became a nation in 1948, but even before that, these Arabs never referred to themselves as Palestinians. Even after Israel became a nation, they didn't refer to themselves as Palestinians. Only from 1964 onward, when Arafat crystallized this strategy to gain the sympathy of the world. Now, in that connection, I'd like to read several quotes. In 1997, Syria's President Assad, who was the father of the current President Assad of Syria, once told Arafat, quote, "You do not represent Palestine as much as we do. Never forget this one point, that there is no such thing as a Palestinian people. There is no Palestinian entity. There is only Syria. You are an integral part of the Syrian people. Palestine is an integral part of Syria. Therefore, it is we, the Syrian authorities, who are the true representatives of the Palestinian people." Okay, another quote from the military commander of the PLO, as well as a member of the PLO Executive Council, Mersin, said, quote, "There is no difference between Jordanians, Palestinians, Syrians, and Lebanese. We are all part of one nation. It is only for political reasons that we carefully underline our Palestinian identity. Yes, the existence of a separate Palestinian identity serves only tactical purposes. The founding of a Palestinian state is a new tool in the continuing battle against Israel." Now, when was that said? This was said, let me get my references here again.
And folks, we're looking at the history of the Palestinians, and from a historical perspective, the name Palestinian only seems to have emerged within the last 40 years or so. Do you have that?
Yes, the Refuge is a newspaper in the Netherlands. I'll spell the name, T-R-O-U-W, and it was the March 31st, 1977 edition.
And the interesting thing about this, Ken, is, you know, you're talking about it in terms of time, the time factor where the name Palestinian became attached to those Arabs that are in this region. And from my perspective, I mean, you mentioned 1964 as the beginning, where you said the intellectual leap was made from being Arabs in that region to being Palestinians with a right to the region. And I was 6 years old at the time. And not that I'm trying to tell you folks how old I am, but the point of that is you've got a major part of the population of this nation that has never known anything different in terms of definition. You know, for my entire lifetime, especially teenager as an adult, whenever you heard the word Palestinian, you automatically thought of Arafat. So we're at a disadvantage, I guess is what I'm saying, because what we've been told for our entire generation is really something that was put in place as a political ploy to make headway. So it's an interesting perspective, but when you go before that, Palestinians, there were no Palestinians is what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I'll qualify that.
Okay.
And this is an interesting, it's an interesting hook. Actually, hopefully very quickly, back in A.D. About 130 something to 140, the Roman nation who conquered Israel just wanted to obliterate it. And they bulldozed Jerusalem, and they gave it a different name. And they used the name Palestine briefly. But that never stuck. You never see it on the maps any place from that time until, shall we say, 1921. So it came to be known, say, from the 1517 onward, especially in the Christian world, it was known as the Holy Land. In 1921, when the after the Balfour Declaration, the League of Nations gave the British nation a mandate over the land of Israel to prepare it for Jewish statehood, it was Great Britain that used the name Palestine for the first time to refer to the Jews.
Ah, okay, and this is in the 20s.
And this is in the 20s and 30s, so that there are postage stamps from Jewish post offices in that time, pre-1948, which was called Palestine by the British now, and these postage stamps say Palestine. The Jerusalem Post, which is a very popular English-speaking paper from Israel, before 1948, when Israel became an independent state, the Jerusalem Post was called the Palestine Post.
Huh.
And it was a Jewish paper. So actually, accentuate this, in 1992, I took a group of ministers, Bible student ministers, and their families to Israel on a fact-finding tour, and Colonel Levy, who was the president and publisher of the Jerusalem Post at the time, spoke to our group, and he says, who are the Palestinians? He says, I'm a Palestinian. I'm a Palestinian. He says, I was born in Israel before it became an independent state, and I was called a Palestinian. I was called a Palestinian before the Arabs were called a Palestinian. All the Jews in the land were called Palestinians before the Arabs took the name in 1965. So that's an interesting hook.
Well, not only is it an interesting hook, hopefully, folks, if you're listening to this, you should start to ask yourself some questions about what is it that we hear on a regular basis, and how much of what we're hearing is really ought to be believable, just from the standpoint of historical accuracy. It's a very, very different perspective here that we're looking at. So, Ken, basically what you're saying is those who are referred to as Palestinians today are truly Arabs.
That's right.
That are part of the conglomeration of nations that surround this little piece of land called Israel.
That's right. Now to give credibility to our claiming that the Arabs were not Palestinians until 1965, why does the majority of the world believe this now?
Right.
Okay. That little state of Israel, which is a speck on the map, surrounded by 22 Arab states, is a thorn in the side to the Arab states. Why? Colonel Levy, when he spoke to us, he said the issue between the so-called Palestinians, the Arabs and the Israelis, is not a land issue. He said it is a religious issue. And he said the Arabs will not rest, the Muslims will not rest, until they take this thorn in their side, this little speck, which is challenging their religion because they are of a different religion, the Jewish religion. This is the real issue.
All right, so,
just one other thing. So, the Arab-rich oil nations put millions and millions and millions of dollars into worldwide propaganda to sell the world on this concept that the Arabs in the land of Israel are the true, inheritors of the land, the originators in the land, and that they are Palestinians.
Okay, and they've obviously done a very good job because the world believes this very clearly. And just before the break, some statistics. Again, and we mentioned at the beginning of the program that, and I only mentioned Arabs from 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 7 nations, total 226 million. Those in Israel total a little between 6 and 7 million. The square miles of those seven Arab nations, Lebanon, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Iran, Iraq, Jordan, and Syria, the square miles in those, just those seven, not the 22 that you're talking about, but just those seven, is 2,165,000 square miles. The square miles in Israel is 8,019. So we are talking, when you say it's a speck, I mean, it really, truly is a little, tiny speck. If, folks, if you look at a map and you look at the amount of territory that causes all of this grief, it is unbelievable how small it is in relation to the lands around it, and the fact that you have in these lands around it so many people that are related through their religious heritage, and then you've got little Israel with a Jewish heritage. It's an amazing thing. Jonathan, we should go into the break at this point. We're just a little bit late on that. Folks, we are talking about the Palestinians, the Jews, Israel, and when we come back from the break, who belongs in Gaza?
This is Jonathan and Rick with Christian Questions on News Talk 102.3 FM, WXLM, with special guest Ken Rawson. Stay with us. Welcome back to Christian Questions on News Talk 102.3 FM, WXLM. Our subject this segment, do Palestinians or Israel belong in Gaza? To be a part of our program, call 860-442-6102. That's 442-6102.
And Jonathan, I'm here with Ken Rawson down in Edison, New Jersey, and we're having this discussion. This is a pretty interesting history lesson, isn't it?
It is.
A little bit different than some folks might have anticipated. But again, when you look at history, and we're not even talking ancient history for the most part. We're just going back to the early 1900s here, and just seeing the changes in things, and as was mentioned earlier, the change in the definition of words even as time goes on, and some of these things are changed for political reasons, unfortunately. Before the break, Ken, we mentioned that I was going to ask you about the history of Gaza. Now, first of all, is Gaza part of the land of Israel that God gave to Israel back in the Old Testament times?
Yes, it is. God promised and he gave the definitions of the land way back in the book of Genesis, and Gaza is mentioned in Genesis 15. It's mentioned in Numbers, the book of Numbers in the Old Testament, the book of Deuteronomy, as being a part of the land that God was giving to Israel. And somebody might say, yeah, but that's the Bible. But the Bible is Jewish history. You know, in Israel, when they study Jewish history, you know, we have in our schools, we have an American history textbook.
Right.
They study the Bible. That's their history. And atheists who are Jews believe that history because they know it's accurate. Ben-Gurion was an atheist for many years, but he accepted the Bible as the accurate history of Israel, and that's what it is. Our Old Testament, the Christian Old Testament, and their Bible, to not, which is the same thing, is their history book. So God gave that land to Israel. Then before 1948, when Israel became an independent state, in 1917, the British government, the Balfour Declaration, declared that the Jewish people would be given the Holy Land as a Jewish state. And Gaza was in that land promised by the Balfour Declaration in 1917. The Balfour Declaration was confirmed by the League of Nations in 1921, and Gaza was a part of that land that Britain was given a mandate over to prepare for a Jewish state.
And I'm assuming the West Bank was part of all of this as well.
Okay, well, let's go a little further than that. Actually, in the Balfour Declaration and in the 1921 League of Nations mandate, the East, well, think of, draw a line in your mind to the audience.
Okay.
The audience. Draw a line in your mind, and to the left of that line, west of that line, and on a map, to the Mediterranean Sea, well, that line is the Jordan River, and west of that to the Mediterranean Sea is the land of Israel.
Okay.
As it is today. East of that is the nation of Jordan,
mm-hmm.
which is three times as large as the western part, which is the land of Israel. Both of those were given. There was no such thing as the nation of Jordan at that time. Both the east of the Jordan River and west of the Jordan River was promised to Israel to be a Jewish state in the League of Nations mandate. In 1922, within a year already, and we won't go into the historic reasons, three-quarters of that territory was chopped off. That's the eastern side of the River Jordan, and made into an Arab emirate that was called Transjordan, and we'll hang that one there. In 1946, Ben-Gurion, who later became the Prime Minister of Israel when it became an independent state, had a settlement, Jewish settlement, established in Gaza. But in the War of Independence, Israel lost Gaza to the Egyptians, and they signed an armistice in 1948 and defined what is called the Gaza Strip.
Right.
And just as in the War of 1948, Israel lost the part of the territory west of the Jordan River, which was called the West Bank. Okay, now, this territory that became the Gaza Strip. First of all, during the 1948 War of Independence, the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, who had fled to Cairo before the war started because he was so anti-Jewish, anti-Semitic actually, broadcast by radio before the 1948 war that all the Arabs in the land of Israel could flee. To leave it clear for the Arab nations, the armies of the six Arab nations to come in and just wipe out the Jews and push them into the sea. And any Arabs that are there, they're going to be killed too. So this is where the refugee problem originated. You hear about the refugee problem.
Right, right.
They fled. They fled to Jordan. They fled to Gaza, and it was not the Israeli government, but it was the UN that made refugee camps, set up refugee camps in the Gaza Strip and refugee camps in Jordan. And these refugee camps are in pitiful condition. But don't blame this on the Israelis. And I just want to quote from a book of the pitiful conditions that were in Gaza, in the West Bank, during this 19-year period between 1948 and 1967, in the next war, in the next war Israel had with the Arabs, and they regained Gaza and the West Bank. But during that 19-year interim, here was the condition of the Arabs in the West Bank and in Gaza. Quote from the book entitled Harsh Realities. For 19 years until 1967, Jordan brutally occupied the renamed West Bank with its 20 UN refugee camps. And when the Western Palestinians, now these are the Palestinians in the West Bank, and when the Western Palestinians rioted in December 55, April 57, April 63, November 66, and April 67. Now, this is the West Bank under the Jordanians. When the Arabs there rioted, King Hussein of Jordan sent in tanks, shelled city streets, machine-gunned people at random, killing hundreds of men, women, and children. Now they're complaining about how the Israelis treat the Arabs in Israel, in the West Bank and Gaza. Then it goes on to say, quote, the Gaza Strip, as it was known for the 19 years of harsh Egyptian occupation, had 8 refugee camps, in which the Palestinians were forced to live in overcrowded squalor. Egypt refused to absorb any refugees into their country, kept them stateless, denied passports, and forbid them to travel or work in Egypt. Emphasis here, for the Palestinian demand to work in the Israel proper.
Mm-hmm.
But under that time, the Egyptians wouldn't let them work in Egypt proper. again, with the quote, for 19 years of brutal occupation of their fellow Arabs, Jordan and Egypt kept these areas in deliberate state of economic stagnation and severe unemployment. Average unemployment in the early 60s ran between 35% and 45%, and up as high as 83%. During this entire period, the world was silent. Only after Israel's seizure of these territories in a defensive war in 1967 did anybody discover the legitimate rights and national aspirations of the Palestinian Arabs. Now, of course, from a humanitarian standpoint, their situation, and we're going on with the quote, improved immeasurably under Israeli administration after 1967. Unemployment is around a mere 1%, and this is in 1989, before the Intifada started.
Mm-hmm.
The Israelis just welcomed the Palestinians into Israel proper and gave them full employment, so there's only 1% unemployment, where under the Jordanians and the Egyptians, it was as high as 83%. And just to show you, well, at that time, now I'm ad-libbing, I'm not quoting, so don't take this as a quote. During that time, there was no electricity in the West Bank and in Gaza. It was the Israelis that brought the electricity in after, and fresh running water after 1967. The infant mortality rate pre-1967 was 140 infant deaths per thousand. And this was brought down by the Israelis with hospitals, modern hospitals and all, to only 30 per 1,000. At a time when the rest of the Arab world still has an infant mortality rate of 80 per 1,000. And, well, I think this is enough time to...
Yeah, we're actually starting to get near the end of our first hour here. But so, if I were to just go back and sum up what you just said, I mean, there was an awful lot there. But the bottom line is, with Gaza and the West Bank, Gaza was part of Israel, and then in 1948, it was lost when they were attacked. Then, 19 years later, Israel was again attacked, and they gained Gaza and the West Bank back.
Mm-hmm. So 1 minute, Rick.
Okay, thank you, Jonathan. In both cases, Gaza and the West Bank were part of Israel, were lost when they were attacked, were regained when they were attacked. So they were part of Israel. Israel is attacked a few times. It gets lost. It gets put back in place. So the big question then has to be, well, if it was part of Israel, why is Israel giving up this land if it belongs to them, if it's part of what was given to them not only by God in the Old Testament, but through the government set up in the 40s? What happened? Something dramatic here is going on. And folks, as we wrap up this first hour, we want to carry that question into the second hour. And it's something that seems so plain in some ways. If Israel, in fact, has a right to this land, why would they give it up? Is this what God wants them to do? Is this what they should do? What are the political ramifications? What are the real reasons behind the giving up of the land? There's so much to cover and so little time. So be sure to join us for the second hour. This is Christian Questions. The question at hand is, do the Palestinians or Israel belong in Gaza? And for Jonathan and Rick, we will be back after the news. But until then, think about it. Someone once said that life shrinks or expands in proportion to one's courage. Good morning, everyone, and welcome back to Christian Questions Talk Radio with your breakfast with Jonathan and Rick. The objective of our program is to discuss with you, our listeners, thought-provoking and meaningful topics based on the Bible. It is a call-in format. We are caller-friendly, and we certainly look forward to hearing your point of view. And, Jonathan, what is the subject that we are discussing this morning?
Well, Rick, our question is, do the Palestinians or Israel belong in Gaza? And our theme text is found in Exodus 32, verse 13. Remember Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, thy servants, to whom thou swearest by thine own self, and saidest unto them, I will multiply your seed as the stars of heaven, and all this land that I have spoken of will I give unto your seed, and they shall inherit it forever.
And, Jonathan, I am sitting here in Edison, New Jersey with Ken Rawson, and in the first hour we did he gave us a real good, sound history lesson on who the Israelis or who the Jews are, who the Palestinians are, and where Gaza actually belongs in terms of biblical prophecy and actually historical record. And so it's a very fascinating history lesson we've had so far. And, folks, if you have a thought on all of this, you're welcome to give us a call at 442-6102. That's 442-6102. And, Ken, at the end of the first hour, we had just mentioned, just by way of recapping, that Gaza was part of what was given to Israel in the 1940s, was lost in their defensive war in 1948 when they became a state, and was regained when they were attacked in 1967. So if it was part of what God gave them originally, it was part of what was given to them back in the 40s, why are they giving it up now? That's the thing. This inquiring mind wants to know the answer to that one.
That's a good question, and I'd like to give a scripture that shows that really the Lord isn't very happy with giving up of land because it's going in the wrong direction. In Micah, the 7th chapter, verse 11, and this is a modern translation, and it's contained, this translation or way of translation is contained in all the translations besides, other than the King James. So it's the unanimous translation of the translators. Micah 7:11, a day will come for rebuilding your walls. On that day, your boundaries will be extended. God is saying that the time is coming, the end times, at the end of the Christian age. In that day, it would be a time for Israel's boundaries to be extended. And what do we see happening? Israel's boundaries are being contracted.
Something's wrong with that picture.
Something's wrong, and God isn't pleased. Okay, why is it being contracted? The Arab so-called Palestinians have two things going for them. One, worldwide propaganda that we mentioned earlier. And what makes this propaganda effective is that the Arab-producing oil-producing states have a large degree of control through OPEC of the price of oil. Western European nations like France are 100% dependent on Arab oil. The United States is 65% dependent on Arab oil. The Arabs have the Western powers and the major nations over an oil barrel. And they're beating them. And they're saying, look, you see world politics the way we see it, but you're not going to get oil. They turned off the oil spigot, remember, in 1973?
Right.
And you had oil gas lines at gas stations 1 mile, 2 miles long.
I remember that.
And the second thing that the Arabs, so-called Palestinians, have going for them is terrorism. Why did Israel give up Gaza? One reason is the cost of the IDF, Israel's military forces, in defending the Jews in Gaza against the Arab terrorism. Was millions and millions and millions of dollars annually, and it brought Israel from a thriving state way down to the point where one-third of their children are in poverty.
All right, now, how many Israelis were living in Gaza at this point in time?
At this point, and that's another point I'm going to make as the reason that Gaza is being given up. 10,000 Arabs lived in Gaza at the point of... Jews lived in Gaza at the point of disengagement. And it wasn't financially feasible for Israel to defend them anymore because the economy was getting so bad. That's one of the reasons. Now, another reason for the giving away is Sharon was just a year and a half before the Gaza disengagement made the statement that Israel will never give up Gaza. Sharon was the one that led the settlements, Jewish settlements in the West Bank and Gaza. Yet, all of a sudden, about a year ago, he flipped and says, we're going to give up Gaza, disengage from Gaza. Why? Well, one of the theories out is that Sharon was up for indictment on three different charges that involved actually illegally acquiring, or he and his family illegally acquiring over several million dollars. Now, at that time, a little over a year ago, his chief advisors told him that one way to avoid indictment, here he's prime minister, he might be indicted, is to give away Gaza. Why? Because the Israeli judicial system is under the left wing. All of the judges are left wing in their political viewpoint. They want the Arabs to have the West Bank and Gaza.
Okay, all right.
So if he can appease these left wing judges, then they might not indict him. Okay, that was a theory for about a year. Then about 3 months before the engagement took place, Two Israeli investigative reporters published a book. The last two chapters of that book documented how that Tehran was under indictment, the facts concerning these indictments being valid, but yet he avoided the indictment because of the Gaza disengagement plan. Then the fourth reason for the disengagement is there were just 10,000 Jews living in Gaza settlers. If there were 50,000, disengagement of Gaza would have been impossible. So, from that standpoint, the Jewish people haven't had sufficient faith to occupy these lands.
All right, now, just one other point on this disengagement here. And folks, again, if you have a thought, give us a call at 442-6102. That's 860-442-6102. Just from a statistical standpoint, when we think about this disengagement in Gaza, what we heard about and what we saw on television were people leaving their settlements. And, you know, they were being forced to leave, and it was, in some ways, a heart-wrenching experience. But there was an awful lot more than that that was left behind, if you will. Just by way of statistics, Israel's second largest dairy farm was abandoned because it was in Gaza. 60% of herbs that are exported from Israel come from Gaza. Those industries were gone. $120 million worth of flowers are exported annually from Gaza. That is no longer part of Israel. Those 10,000 people that left now need new employment. 60% of Israel's cherry tomato exports come from Gaza, no longer. And 1,000 acres of greenhouses were abandoned, and 70% of its organic produce was lost. So this disengagement wasn't just people having to uproot and change where they lived, but a big chunk of Israel's commerce has been left behind. Now, what happened to these dairy farms and these greenhouses and this organic the cherry tomato exports and all of that? Do you have any insight as to have the Palestinians picked up those industries and are they running with them?
After the disengagement of the settlers took place, several weeks after the disengagement was completed, the IDF, the Israeli military forces, withdrew from Gaza at a designated date. They officially turned it over to the Palestinians. And the Palestinians were supposed to police it. They had agreed. They had made an agreement with the Egyptians. There was the border between Gaza and Egypt, in which large amounts of arms, the Palestinians would dig tunnels under that border. The Israelis were on top of the land patrolling to stop any flow of armaments from Egypt to the Palestinians, the terrorists. But the Palestinians would dig long tunnels and bring in large pieces of equipment of arms. So when the disengagement before took place, Israel decided not to keep patrolling what they called the Philadelphia Corridor, but they made an arrangement where the Egyptian army, the Egyptian army would patrol that to prevent the Palestinians from smuggling armaments in. You know, that's just like hiring a fox to guard a chicken coop.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous. Okay. After the IDF officially withdrew and turned the land over to the Palestinian administration, Gaza over to the Palestinian administration, there were 3 weeks of utter chaos and anarchy. What happened to the farm, wonderful farms, and the hothouses and the farm equipment, which all amounted to millions of dollars? In a fury of negotiations and activity, Morton Zuckerman, who is the publisher of the U.S. News and World Report, after receiving a phone call from Wolfson, a Jewish Undersecretary of State for the Middle East, they devised a plan where a Jewish philanthropic organization in the United States would buy from the settlers, so the settlers wouldn't lose out in all of this farm equipment and the valuable hothouses where they grew all of this produce that was exported. And you gave the statistics on the exporting. Zuckerman himself gave $500,000. But I forget how many millions of dollars were raised to buy from the settlers. So the settlers really got their money for these farms and their hothouses. And they were to be given to the Palestinians intact.
Okay, Ken, hold that thought.
Okay,
because we have to go into a break at this point. Jonathan, let's hit the break right now. And when we come back, obviously, we're going to find out how this plan worked out or perhaps didn't work out in the turning over of the territory of Gaza to the Palestinians.
This is Jonathan and Rick with Christian Questions on News Talk 102.3 FM, WXLM. Grab your Bibles. Don't go away. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Christian Questions on News Talk 102.3 FM, WXLM. Our subject this segment, do the Palestinians or Israel belong in Gaza? To be a part of our program, call 860-442-6102. That's 442-6102. And Rick, I'm going to make the announcement that we're offering a free DVD video of Israel Fulfilling Bible Prophecy. Ken Rossin has produced this and created it. And the address for this free DVD, if our listeners want to write this address down, is Christian Questions, P.O. Box 1837, New London, Connecticut, 06320. Again, P.O. Box 1837 for the free DVD offer, Israel Fulfilling Bible Prophecy.
Also, Jonathan, if they like, they can request it online at christianquestions.net. You can just go in there and put a request in and give us an address, and we'll send it to you. So that's www.christianquestions.net. Thanks for that, Jonathan. So just before the break, Jonathan, as we were talking, Ken was explaining in the turning over of the land of Gaza from Israeli occupation, if you will, to the Palestinians, we had these thriving farm areas and so forth. And that took when they started, when they built these farms, Ken, you know, years ago, what was the condition of the land when they started? And then what was the condition of the land when they turned it over?
Well, the condition of the land was that it was a wilderness, barren wilderness.
I don't want to interrupt too much, but we do have a call waiting on hold there, Rick.
Okay. Let's take the call first before you get into that. So, Jonathan, let's go to the phone call right now.
Okay, welcome to Christian Questions. This is Jonathan and Rick and guest Ken Rossin. Who are we speaking with?
Good morning. This is Julius.
Good morning, Julius.
I call earlier. I mean, my slot is usually I call a lot earlier than this, but I've been so fascinated by Mr. Rossin's commentaries, introduction, that I waited till now. So, to me, this topic is always exciting, and I give you some reasons why I'm excited about this topic. Number one, without the Jews, there would be no Bible. Number two, God's implicit affection for the Jews, and he says in Amos, the book of Amos, chapter 3, verse 2, you only have I known of all the families of the earth. And in Zechariah 2:8, he says, whoso toucheth you, God says to the Jews, toucheth the apple of mine eye. That's pretty affectionate, isn't it?
It certainly is.
And Zechariah reason number four why I'm excited about Jewish history and the their effect upon the whole human race. Reason number four, Zechariah 14:17 states that once God's government is set up on the earth with the Jews as the prominent nation, that any nation that will not comply to the new government, God will withhold the rain from them. That's reason number four. And reason number five why I'm excited about this topic is that ultimately all nations shall be blessed because of the blessings and deliverance that will come upon and for the Jews. So my summary is this, as I leave you. And first of all, I do want to thank Mr. Rosen, Ken Rosen, for what a wonderful history and storehouse of knowledge he has in Israel. We certainly appreciate his sharing with us. But three things I would say in conclusion as I leave you. Remember, two things are for sure in life. Number one is death. Number two is taxes. And I add number three. Israel will prosper because God will deliver them, and all nations shall be blessed with them. Thank you for sharing. God bless.
Thank you, Julius. We appreciate your input.
Have a good day.
Take care.
Well, so, Jonathan, it sounds like Julius is excited about the topic, and that's a good thing.
Yes, he is.
There's certainly a lot to be looking at here. Thank you, Julius, for that call. And, Ken, as we get back to this, we were talking about the condition of the land in Gaza when they began to develop it, and you said it was a barren wasteland, and that's about as far as you got. So why don't we just pick up that thought and continue?
Yes. Now, during the period from 1948 to 1967, when Egypt occupied Gaza, the Arabs there did not develop the land. Excuse me. They lived in refugee camps. Quick, interesting point. The Israeli government would build houses. Each year, they'd set aside a certain amount of money to build houses for the poor Palestinian refugees in the camps to get them out of those terrible conditions. In the Arab nations, at the General Assembly, not the Security Council, General Assembly, where they had the controlling influence, but had the General Assembly of the UN vote condemnation on the Israelis for moving these poor refugees out of these refugee camps that were terrible conditions into new housing. Why? Because they wanted these refugee camps as show places. And I could give you quotes from historians and from British officers who were really pro-Arab to show the why, this despicable reason why the Arabs wanted these refugee camps. As a showcase to the world, oh, look how the Israelis are treating these poor Palestinians. All these poor Palestinians during that 19 years made no effort to develop the land. And then Israel got the land in 67.
Rick, we have another call.
Okay, well, hold on to that call for a minute. Let Ken finish this thought. Go ahead.
Who were these Jewish settlers? Well, they weren't farmers. By nature, by trade, probably some of them were teachers at one time before they moved to Israel. You know, doctors moved to Israel, and there was not enough work for so many doctors, so they did manual labor. They had because they had the idea of Zionism. So these settlers devised ways that they could develop the land. They implemented hothouses. The Israeli Gaza settlers became the leaders in world agriculture, in organic farming, producing produce that was affected by chemicals, fertilizers, and didn't have pesticides. So much were their organic farming produce in demand that the last 3 years, the European Union required that all imports from Gaza be labeled Gaza, not Israel, and they would have to pay an additional import tax tariff. But the Europeans paid that extra price because the demand of Israeli produce was so great. And the Israelis developed this over a period of 10 years, and these farms just became so productive. Okay, let's get to what happened to them. Here we saw how the funds were raised by philanthropic, Jewish philanthropic.
Okay, actually, hold that because we want to get to that call.
Okay, so we'll take the call. Welcome to Christian Questions. This is Jonathan and Rick. Who are we speaking with?
Good morning, it's Don.
Good morning, Don.
Who belongs in Gaza? The people who lived there before the 67 war.
Is it the people? Wait, Don, let me ask you a question. Is it people who lived there before the 67 war, or is it people who lived there back in the 1940s? Because there was two different groups of people.
The people who were there before the 67 war would include people in the 40s.
Okay.
The mischief of the 67 war should be undone, and the people who lived there and had property there should have that property restored to them.
The mischief of the 67 war?
Yeah. Israel's war of aggression against its neighbors.
Aggression?
I think so.
Huh.
And when will the public stop hearing this twaddle about the Israelis were the attacked ones in 67?
Because that's the truth.
Well, really? Menachem Begin says otherwise. He was quoted by Noam Chomsky in Chomsky's book, The Fateful Triangle, and Menachem Begin had this to say, quote, "In June 67, we again had a choice. The Egyptian army concentrations in the Sinai approaches do not prove that Nasser was really about to attack us. We must be honest with ourselves. We decided to attack him." Close quote, Menachem Begin. Who I suppose would be in a good position to know.
Okay, and your point then is what? Israel is getting what they deserve because of what you're saying they did in 67?
No, because of what they did in 67, they got what they didn't deserve. They got the Gaza Strip, and they didn't deserve it. And they should get out. Lock, stock, and barrel.
So the fact that they were given it before then has nothing to do with anything?
Given it by whom? God?
Well, first of all, yeah, and foremost, yes. Go ahead, Ken.
Given by the League of Nations in 1921. The League of Nations said that the territory on both sides of the Jordan River, which included Gaza, would be given to Great Britain as a mandate to prepare for a Jewish state. This was the nations of the world.
No, it was not.
Wait a while. Just let me finish this so we didn't interrupt you. The nations of the world had been extremely generous to the Arabs. The Arabs have received 22 independent states. They have received from the League of Nations and the UN territory that 5,400,000 square miles, and the Jews asked for less than 1%, and they ended up with, including the Gaza Strip, less than 1/4 of this 1%. So the Arabs have no problem. Now, who were the pre-1967 occupants of the Gaza Strip? Arabs, yes. They came from where? They fled before the 1948 War of Independence because the Grand Mufti broadcast from Cairo, as we said before, that they should flee to lead the way open for the nations, armies of six Arab nations to just come and wipe the Jews out, push them into the sea, and then they could go back to the land afterwards. So it was these refugees that ended up in these refugee camps in Gaza. They weren't the original settlers in Gaza. They were refugees. Now, the Arab nations persecuted the Jews that were living in their territories at this time, so that 600,000 Jewish refugees fled the Arab states, just as Arabs fled Israel to escape the war, and then they were going to return afterwards. What did the Jews do with the 600,000 Jewish refugees? Did they say, okay, you Arab states, take them back now. You confiscated all their land. You murdered a lot of them. You persecuted. No. The Israeli infant state absorbed at great economic cost these 600,000 refugees from the Arab states. The Arab nations, with less than 1% of their annual Arab income, could easily have absorbed the Arab refugees in Gaza and in the West Bank, who some say numbered 600,000. Ben-Gurion said, I have the exact figures, and there are 180,000. But it would have been easy for the Arab state to absorb them. These settlers, inhabitants in Gaza, pre-67, were refugees that fled Israel proper because of the war.
All right, Don, any additional comments? Because we're approaching time for a break.
Well, here's something from Yitzhak Rabin regarding the 67 war, which was launched by Israel against its Arab neighbors on the pretext that the Arabs were gathering to attack Israel. Israel struck first. You remember who it was that caught whose Air Force on the ground? It was the Israelis who shattered the Egyptian Air Force while that Air Force was on the ground, not the other way around.
Right.
Okay. So that really ought to suggest to any objective observer that the Israelis struck first. Otherwise, it would have been Egyptian MiGs catching Israeli planes on the ground. But here we are with Yitzhak Rabin, quote again, quote, I do not think Nasser wanted war. The two divisions he sent to the Sinai would not have been sufficient to launch an offensive war. He knew it, and we knew it. That's Yitzhak Rabin, quoted in Le Monde in 1968. And someday, we'll stop hearing this lie about how Israel was attacked in 67. It's nice propaganda, but it's a lie.
Okay, Don, thank you very much for your call. We appreciate it.
Bye.
And we actually should go into a break first, and then we'll take your comments on that afterwards. So, Jonathan, let's go into the break right now. Folks, we're talking about the condition of Israel, looking at Gaza, and who belongs where. And obviously, there's a lot of different opinions going around. So stay with us.
This is Jonathan and Rick with Christian Questions on News Talk 102.3 FM, WXLM. Don't go away. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Christian Questions on News Talk 102.3 FM, WXLM. Our subject this segment, do the Palestinians or Israel belong in Gaza? To be a part of our program, call 860-442-6102. That's 442-6102 with special guest Ken Rawson.
And Jonathan, we're with Ken here. I'm in Edison, New Jersey with him. And Ken, three things. Perhaps make a comment to wrap up that conversation with Don in the last segment, get back to what happened to the agriculture in Gaza, and then let's look at future events.
All right, quickly on Don's point. I don't contest the Rabin's quotation. I knew Rabin. I spent an hour and a half with him, the longest meeting I had. And he had his reason for making that statement. I can quote, we can quote statements from others, that there was no doubt that Egypt was preparing for an attack. And yes, Israel did strike first. Why? when Nasser demanded that the UN remove their forces. What could the reason be? Their forces were there to prevent a war between Egypt and Israel. Now, Nasser demanded that the forces be removed. So Israel, who started the war? Yes, Israel struck first, but in self-defense. It was a defensive first strike because the Egyptian and the Syrian armies and the Jordanian army were so overwhelmingly superior in number to Israel's forces that when a war was inevitable, Israel did what they had to do in self-defense and strike first. All right, now getting back to Gaza.
Okay.
What happened to all the agricultural equipment and farms and hothouses that were purchased by this philanthropic Jewish group to be given to the Palestinians administration? The first day after the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, withdrew from Gaza, mobs of Palestinians just flooded the former settlements and they destroyed everything. They cut their own nose off. Here they were going to be given, and they were told ahead of time, the government was told ahead of time, the Palestinian administration was told ahead of time, that they were going to be given all of these farms that were so thriving and Israel made millions of dollars on. Their own people destroyed them. There was complete chaos for 3 weeks. Now, the Egyptian army was supposed to patrol the Philadelphia corridor, but they didn't do anything. The Palestinians, by the thousands, rushed across the border, brought back huge quantities of armament. And one of the amusing aspects is that over 100 Egyptian men married Palestinian women at that time who crossed the border. Why? Because, you know, an Arab man, when he gets married, he marries the girl whose family has the highest and the most valuable dowries. Okay? And the Palestinian families were more wealthy than the Egyptian families. And this is something that, you know, isn't known. So that it's a prize for a non-Palestinian heir to marry a Palestinian woman because he gets a huge dowry. Actually, the per capita income of the average Palestinian is higher than the per capita income of the average Arabs in the Arab states. That's the reality. Now, for 3 weeks, there was complete chaos. And to this day, there is still this anarchy in the Gaza state. The Palestinians are murdering Palestinians. There's rivalry between the different terrorist groups. There's rivalry between different Palestinian clans. And even Palestinians are kidnapping Palestinian authority officials and demanding a ransom or demanding a job. I want work. Now, we'll get back to this person that we kidnapped if you give X number of us certain jobs. So it is just anarchy in Gaza at this point. Now, what effect will this have on the West Bank? Well, the Palestinians feel they've accomplished the giving up of Gaza through their continual terrorism. So now they are planning continual terrorism in the West Bank in order to get the Israeli government to give up the West Bank.
So you don't think then giving up Gaza is going to reduce terrorism at all?
No. Before the disengagement took place, every Israeli general said that there will be more terrorism after Gaza is given up. the Secretary of Defense of, or the Minister of Defense of the Israeli Defense Forces said no, it'd be less. But 2 weeks after Gaza was given up, he switched his position and said, yes, there will be more terrorism in the West Bank because the Palestinians will feel that they got Gaza through the pressure of terrorism. They will get Israel to give up the West Bank through the pressure of terrorism.
Okay, so what we have is a pretty sad end result up to this point, at any rate, of the agriculture in Gaza, not to mention the people that were that left their homes, not to mention that the destruction that happened, not to mention that the fact that all of the synagogues that were left behind were destroyed. And that's all just, it's all backwards from perhaps where it ought to go. One interesting side point, again, that I don't know a lot of us know, is that of the citizenry in Israel, about 1 million of Israel's citizens are Arabs. And they have equal voting rights and equal rights along with the Jews in Israel. And that's, I'm bringing that up as a side point because it proves to me anyway that if you have tolerance, you can live together. And the Jews set up a government that allowed Arabs to be part of.
Just a quick thing on that.
Yes.
When Israel became an independent state, the Israeli government and the Ben Gurion said that every Arab that lives within Israeli boundaries is automatically an Israeli citizen. This wasn't a special purpose. It was something that was given to every Arab who lived within the state of Israel.
So, I mean, folks, think about that for a second. Just think about that. Weigh out what we're talking about here, and it gives you a whole different perspective than perhaps you may have heard or seen on the news and so forth. And we are starting to run out of time here. What's going to happen in the future? I mean, and you've got about 6 minutes to put this all together. Good luck to you, brother. You know, in terms of land and prophecy, what do you see from a biblical perspective that's happening from here on and forward?
Okay. The prophet Jeremiah in several places speaks of a time in which they will say, peace, peace, and there shall be no peace. And he's particularly speaking of the territory that Israel was in. So although we might apply this on a worldwide basis, by extension, the prophecy specifically applies to end times in Israel. And this is what the peace process is all about. The Oslo peace process that began in 1992, they will say peace, peace, and there will be no peace. They said peace in Gaza, we'll give up Gaza, the Israelis are foolishly going to give up parts of the West Bank, we don't know how much yet, and for the sake of peace, and they want peace. But there will be no peace, because there are definite scriptures that show that there's going to be a future Israeli-Arab war. I don't mean just a war between Israel and the Palestinians, but a war that will engage a number of the Arab states that are round about. We won't take time to read these prophecies, but in Isaiah 11, the 11th verse speaks about Israel's regathering during end times, and in verse 14, it shows that the Jews are regathered, that they will have a war against those who are on the west, the Philistines who are on the west. And it's referring to Philistinian territory, which is Gaza. It was ancient Philistinian territory. And they're going to win that war. So that verifies that Gaza is going to stay in Arab hands until this future war. Then it speaks of Israel in the verse 14, then having a war with Ammon, Moab, and Edom on the east. These are ancient territories that are now a part of modern Jordan. Ammon is the capital city of Jordan. So Jordan will be involved in this war. And it says in verse 14 that the children of Ammon and Moab will obey Israel as a result of this war. So they will get territory on the eastern bank of Jordan, which is a part of the nation of Jordan, perhaps the whole nation of Jordan. Syria and Egypt, just came out in the news this week, are getting information on valuable information on nuclear development, and it is just a matter of time that they both have a atom bomb or nuclear bombs. So fury is mentioned in a part of the future war. Damascus will become a ruinous heap. And Zechariah 14, also rather Zephaniah 2, speaks of a war in end times in which Israel will have a battle with the inhabitants of Gaza and defeat them. And then in verses 8 through 10, it speaks of them having a battle with Moab and Ammon, which is Jordan, and they will defeat them. So Israel will regain, not only would they give up at the Gaza Strip and the West Bank, but additional territory, southern Lebanon and Jordan. Now we feel that after this, in Ezekiel 38, which all Bible students of prophecy, whatever their denomination, agree is a future war that the nations of the north come down to Israel. In Ezekiel 38:10, it speaks of Israel this time dwelling in peace and safety, unwalled villages. We feel that after the next Arab-Israeli war, the UN and the Western powers will accept the new borders, but they'll say, enough is enough, no more wars in the Middle East, we're going to demilitarize. And this is how Israel will become a land of unwalled villages, but dwelling prosperously at peace. We could give more scriptures to buttress this fact that they will demilitarize and leave their future defense in the hands of the Western powers. Now, going on quickly, there will be this invasion of the hordes of the North, Gog, and the forces of Russia with certain allies in verse 6 that I mentioned. Zechariah 14, speaking of the same war, says, I will gather all nations against Jerusalem. And then God will fight for Israel as he fought for them in the days of old. The enemies will be defeated. Christ's kingdom will be set up in Jerusalem as the capital of his kingdom on earth. And in Zechariah, the 12th chapter, verses 9 through 11, it speaks of the Jews at that time as they're receive this great deliverance from these invading forces, they will look upon him whom they appear. They'll realize that actually the power of the Lord that is leading them to victory is none other than Christ.
Okay, Ken, I hate to cut you off, but we are out of time. So thank you for that summation on the historical perspective, not only looking back, but looking forward through prophecy. And Ken, thank you for being with us this morning. It's been very, very fascinating. I would love to have another program where we can develop this even further, and maybe we can do that in the future. Folks, we've been talking about Israel and Gaza, looking at it historically, and hopefully you've heard some things here that will really help you to analyze this from a different perspective. But just realize, God is over in control of the whole matter when it comes down to the final say. For Jonathan and Rick, this is Christian Questions. Does Israel belong in Gaza? Just wait and see. But till then, think about it.